Session number 11105, Colonel M. McBain, Reel 2.
Given, I forget what it was, a pound perhaps? I don't know. But I do remember there were, I think it was the normal thing, swearing the oath and signing various bits of paper. I think we were given, I forget what it was, a pound perhaps? I don't know. But I do remember there were, I think it was the normal thing, swearing the oath and signing various bits of paper. There were two other people going through the same procedure as myself from Wellington College, which was nearby. And they, for far stronger reasons than me, were enlisting also into Highland regiments. That was purely coincidental and accidental.
You had no fancy for the kilt or anything of that
nature? No, as far as I was concerned, I had no connections at all with Highland Regiment. It was just a thought that I would go, because I knew by that time that my basic training would be at Fort George if I joined the Highland Regiment. And I'm now trying to think of when this was. This would be April 49. From memory, April 4th. And very quickly after that, off I went on the night train from Euston, the 7:20 from Euston, which was a splendid train, which I got to know fairly well, but this particular one was the first time I'd been on it. It was a sleeper, and the two heroes that I'd met in the recruiting office in Reading were on the same train. And in fact, we became very close friends thereafter. We went up, and as you had breakfast as you were crossing Rannoch Moor on that train, you had your kippers and porridge, and you were tipped out in Inverness, and off we went.
How did you find your own fare? Or was
it no, we were given a railway warrant with our joining instructions. We arrived at Fort George, where it was the Highland Brigade Training Centre and the Highland Light Infantry with a training battalion. And we arrived as part of a large national service intake of recruits. And we were actually in the fort, which was built after the 1745 rebellion, and I don't think it had been changed very much since. And it really was a very grim place. In a barrack room with, I think, six or eight people in it. And these were national servicemen who'd been called up from all over the place, mainly Scotland, obviously. Without putting too fine a point on it, they were pretty rough old things, some of them. What always impressed us in the first few weeks when we were all together was that quite a lot of them struggled a bit with reading and writing, but come Thursday payday, they could count the money very, very quickly. We did the very basic training, marching and so on, in the fort before we were separated out into a potential officer squad. However, perhaps of interest, within a few days of arriving in Fort George, we had the normal sort of army inoculation program for everything. And there was one monster that we had. And thinking about all the care and trouble that is taken nowadays with needles and hygiene and so on, I think we had the same needle for the whole lot. and it was TAB inoculum. Anyway, we had it. But the next morning, when I woke up, I had reacted to this inoculation, and I'd swollen up all over. I couldn't get boots on. I couldn't get anything on. And of course, I was 18, as a youngster. I must have been 19, but as a youngster, you know, really hadn't been away out in the big wide world very much. At home, one would have sent for the doctor, but you can't lie in a barrack room in the middle of Fort George and say, send in the doctor. However, this, of course, is one of the learning points in the army. The mates gathered round, and one of them went to the medical room and said, oh, we've got someone who's ill. What do we do? And a medical orderly came, and I was taken off to the little medical centre and spent 3 days in there getting over this reaction. And then I had a day in that splendid uniform that people wore in those days, the white shirt and a red tie, blue trousers and a blue jacket. When that was invented, I don't know, whether it was the First World War or before. But it certainly identified you as someone in hospital.
This was the wounded soldier's uniform.
Yeah.
How were you received when you first went into the Fort George? You mentioned the bad word. How were you received as you went in?
I just can't remember, Harry. I just cannot remember. I've been making it up, I think. Well, in fact, I know I've been making it up. With knowledge now, I can assume what did happen, but I just can't remember.
You would have.
I mean, at that time, of course, you see, it was such a completely strange world, and there were so many things to do and think about and so on. But the actual. Obviously, the administrative machinery was pretty slick. I don't know how many were in this intake, but there must have been 300 or 400. And so obviously the machinery was there to cope with that without us noticing it. So the actual details, I just no idea. I mean, I was in a barrack room with five others. We got issued with denims, boots, basic equipment. But as I say, I wore this red, white, and blue stuff before I wore proper uniform. I then went back to the barrack room. It was very soon after that that we were taken out and put into a potential officer squad. There were, in fact, I suppose, about a dozen of us on our way to Sandhurst. And we knew it, and obviously the army knew it, and Fort George knew it, but nobody else did, none of the people, National Service people. And we were joined by, I think, probably another dozen National Servicemen who had been picked out as potential officers somehow. Because they were straight off the streets. They had not been to any through any selection process other than in Fort George. I should think probably it was largely done on education. We moved out of the fort into a wooden hutted encampment just outside the walls. And we had one hut to ourselves. And we had a platoon commander from the Highland Light Infantry, Ian Thompson, and a platoon sergeant, Sergeant Weed, Ian Weed from the Gordon Highlanders. And they launched our military careers, really. Ian Thompson had just left Sandhurst. He'd just finished at Sandhurst, so he must have been intake two, possibly, or three. And he was determined to show us what was what, which was fine. One was young and was ready for that sort of thing. Sergeant Weed, he, I honestly don't know what his background was. He'd served, obviously, during the war with the Gordons, and sadly was killed later in Malaya with the Gordons. And there were, I suppose, again, in that sort of environment, tales spring round. And the tale about Ian Weed was that, in fact, he had very much the same sort of education as us, but had refused a commission for some reason. And certainly he gave that impression. He wasn't the great loudmouthed, bullying, thick-headed old sergeant that one tended to come across a bit in those days. He was a bit different, which obviously was why he'd been put with us. And that didn't mean to say he didn't run us around, but he did it very well, and none of us, there was no resentment. We accepted whatever Sergeant Weed said or did without hesitation. And from that one, therefore, realizes that he was a leader of the very best sort. Those two laid the foundations of our military career. And although we were in our own hut as a potential officer group, platoon, we were still private soldiers, and we did all the things that all the others were doing, guards and washing up the cookhouse utensils in the Murray Firth, without the aid of any soap powder or anything, because there was no hot water in the cookhouse or something, I don't know what. But we were treated slightly, as time went on, when we got to grips with things a bit, we were treated slightly differently, and I think two things. We went on an expedition to Ben Wyvis, which is north of Inverness. It's a mountain, and we were told to go and climb that. The tragedy struck there is the fellow who again became a firm friend. He was National Service, but became regular a lot later on. We had bought an ounce of tobacco between us before we went on this expedition. So that's all we could afford. And he was actually carrying the tobacco. And the clown fell in a bog halfway up this mountain. And so we abandoned the expedition and laid our precious tobacco out on a rock in the sun to dry it. And the other difference from memory was that when the rest of the intake was doing PT and route marches and so on, we were taken off to the gymnasium where we were put under the pipe major to be taught Scottish country dancing, which was fine. I mean, that was great. And that, again, was interesting because a number of the others in this group, they had very close connections with Scottish regiments. Their fathers or families had been in the Gordons or the Argylls or Camerons for some generations, and that's where they were going. They knew when they finished at Sandhurst they were going into those regiments. And of course they thought they were the experts on Scottish country dancing, but the pipe major soon persuaded them that they didn't know quite as much as they thought they did, which was quite amusing to someone who'd never done it before.
You said it was basic training.
Yeah.
What form did that take?
Well, initially drill, weapon training on the short Lee Enfield 303 rifle, 303 Bren, basic section tactics, and fitness training, PT, and so on. But of course, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's maybe I'm just thinking that things were better than they were. But I think we were all pretty fit when we went there. We were that sort of person, I suppose. We'd all played rugby at school and or football or whatever it was. And so the rigours of PT and route marches and so on didn't hurt us so much as they obviously hurt some of the poor souls in the National Service intake who had never, ever done anything of that sort before. And so that doesn't stick in one's mind as being unpleasant or anything. The only unpleasant thing I can remember, and we all found this unpleasant for various reasons, but it was very, very hard physically. For some reason, there was a great ploy made of bayonet training, and we used to go into the moat of the fort, where there were bayonet dummies, sandbags on stands, and you'd go round the moat with Sergeant Weed encouraging you, Solist, and that was tough. And we did find that tough physically, and I think mentally. Why, and whether anybody else did that, I don't know. We certainly did. Whether any of the other squads did this, I don't know.
What bayonet were you using at this stage?
This was the spike bayonet, six inches, I think, 6 to 8 inches spike bayonet that fitted on the end of the Shortley Enfield.
Had you had it explained to you just how efficient this was as a weapon?
Yes, the indications were from Sergeant Weed that he had actually used it in action, and certainly he, to us impressionable youngsters, gave the impression that he'd been at it with his bayonet, and made sure that we did the same, you know. But as I say, whether we were the only ones who did this or whether every other squad in the place did it, I honestly don't know. And then we, again, as a squad, progressed slightly into doing... There's an area outside Fort George called the Roughs. The Roughs is not at Fort George. The Roughs is at the School of Musketry at Hythe. No, it's the Common. It's the Common outside Fort George. And it's scrubland, bushes and so on. We then started to do little section exercises. And I'm quite certain the other squads were not doing this. And we had little radios. We were given 88 sets, which were the section radios at that time. And it was, again, thinking about it now, one realizes that we, in fact, had finished our basic training, and they were beginning to wonder what to do with this bunch. What was happening was the National Service element in the platoon were going off to do their War Office selection board, and either passing or failing. If they failed, they came back and went into one of the ordinary squads, who were then ready for posting and drafting out two battalions. If they passed their WASB, they went off to Eaton Hall and did their officer training there. But that left the Sandhurst bunch. And then someone somewhere decided that all the infantry candidates going to Sandhurst would, on finishing their basic training, would go down to the School of Infantry at Warminster and join up in the demonstration battalion. And so that's what we did. Before leaving Fort George, I went with one other, whose name I forget, to Cameron Barracks in Inverness, where we were issued with our kilts. And so we were proper soldiers by the time we were allowed to wear the kilt. And off we all went. Specimens from each of the Highland regiments down to Warminster to Nook Camp, where the Lancashire Fusiliers were ensconced. They, having just come back from one of these extraordinary places that, you know, you just hear about now, in Eritrea or Abyssinia or somewhere. So now I've heard it on the radio not very long ago. You know, the current civil war going on in Ethiopia. Doesn't matter, they'd just come back from there. And they were all a pretty tough lot. Most of them had been in the war. And certainly, we were, I mean, there were a lot of us, Sandhurst people, by this time. We were two platoons worth, big platoons, you know, 40, 50 strong. And our platoon commander was a strange man. He was a captain in the Lancashire Fusiliers. Who really didn't make a great impact. The only, I suppose, naturally enough, at that level and that stage of the proceedings, really the only person who made any impact was our section corporal. I can't remember his name, but he was a big Lancastrian. He was a smashing man. And I think, really, he didn't understand us. Nobody in the battalion, nobody in the 1st Battalion in Lancashire has understood us. Because suddenly, there were all these people from every infantry regiment in the British Army there as private soldiers. And they didn't know whether they'd call us sir or what we were. And they were confused. We were not too clear how we formed these two platoons. And we took part in all the demonstrations at the School of Infantry. Section demonstrations and platoon demonstrations, company demonstrations, which was interesting for us. One of the unusual things we were involved with was a firepower demonstration, which of course the School of Infantry still does. It's a traditional thing, but in those days of I think slightly smaller scale. But whether it was the whole platoon or whether it was just a section, certainly I was involved with a thing called a baby viper. And a baby viper was in its infancy, I think. And what it was 100 feet or so of explosive-filled hose in a coil. And there was a rocket that took this hose across a minefield, and when the hose was on the minefield, it was detonated, and that, in theory, cleared a path through the minefield. And certainly, I was part of this group that had to demonstrate the Viper, baby Viper. It was a big one, which was launched from a tank, from memory, and that was to get tanks through, but this was a baby Viper for infantry. And it was hilarious. I mean, we went off and nobody knew what was going to happen with this thing. I don't know who'd invented it, but it was a rocket, and you put it on a tripod sort of launching stand, and the hose was in wooden boxes, and so if you were unlucky enough to be in that part of the gang, you carried one of these wooden boxes on your back, plastic-filled hose pipe. And then you trotted along and eventually got to where it was going to be launched from, and the guy with the tripod put that down, and then the person with the rocket on his back put that on the launching thing, connected up all the... put the boxes down on the ground, flat, and they were rather like fish boxes. Wooden fish boxes, a hose in the boxes, it was all coiled up, you connected each box up, and then at the given moment someone fired this rocket, and off it went, towing all the hose pipe behind it out of his box. For the first few times, I mean, the rocket just went. It was a free-flying rocket, and it went anywhere it thought of going. And so you had hundreds of feet of plastic-filled hose pipe snaking around Salisbury Plain. I think once or twice we got it right, but I mean, we couldn't control it. There was no question of guiding it or anything.
Did it become into regular use?
Not that I'm aware of, because I don't... You see, well, no, I don't think, you see, until Korea, we ever came, I mean, there were no minefields, and certainly I wasn't aware of it being used in Korea. So, I don't think it was ever taken into use, because I do remember one demonstration, and the rocket went off, and the whole assembled audience had to flee from this rocket and its hose pipe. So... That was that, but what was interesting, you see, having done all those demonstrations as private soldiers, when we went back, most of us anyway, after Sandhurst to do our platoon commander's course at Warminster, demonstrations, the things hadn't changed at all, and so we had done all these exercises, and so we were able to really defeat the object of the thing. I can remember going on my platoon commander's course, we did one exercise with the company commander's division, the old soldiers, and I was paired up with a marine captain. I was a second lieutenant, he was a marine captain, and did this attack, company attack or something. We got up to the top of this hill, and I was number two on the Bren, he was number one on the Bren, I was number two. He said, "Right, dig in. Come on, we've got to dig." And I said, "No, there's no point in digging. It finishes now. Finished. No, we've got to dig in." And he got his shovel out and he started digging away. And Salisbury Plain's a pig to dig in. It's chalk and flint and very unpleasant. And I just stood there and smoked a cigarette and said, "You're wasting your time." And sure enough, you know, as soon as he got going, the whistle blew and that was that. However, that's jumping over a bit.
How had you taken to army life personally up to now?
I just accepted it. I hadn't expected anything better or anything worse. It was just life to me. I'd known nothing else. I just fell into it. There was no pain or suffering or mental anguish or anything. I'm not aware. Quite genuinely, I don't think of it any time saying, "My God, I wish I hadn't done this." And I think genuinely the group that I'd started off with at Fort George, we remained friends so far as one can in the army when we were scattered all over the place. But I mean, if I can really jump up now to the present day, David Saunders, who is secretary of the Lowland TA Association in Glasgow with at Reading in 1949, and you know we're still close friends.
You'd been in some time and you'd been through different units in effect.
Yes.
Had you come across in the backroom situation any forms of bullying or initiation?
No, there was none of that. In the very basic barrack room in Fort George, I think, from memory, the main memory of that is we're all in this together, and we'll beat the buggers. You know, I don't know. I think we were all, although, obviously, I was the only sort of pre-Sandhurst person in that particular barrack room, and there was no question of them ganging up on me or me thinking the worst of them. We were all in it together, one way or another. No, there was none of that which one hears about now. I think, and I will jump in with both feet here, I think that is probably because the NCOs were about that. They'd a war. They were all old soldiers, experienced soldiers who'd been through the war. and the officers, particularly the young platoon commanders, were dedicated young officers who looked after their soldiers. And there was never any opportunity. You see, it's only since I've left the army that this business of bullying and initiation ceremonies and all this rubbish has come to the fore. It may have been going on, but I certainly, in my service, didn't come across it. I suspect that is the reason. I mean, we respected, we may not have liked them, but we respected all our NCOs. And they're all experienced people.